Namaste, sir. How are you?
Namaste. Thank you very much. I'm doing well.
Thank you for coming here, sir, and talking to us. Sir, first of all, I would like to ask you that when you became RBI governor, you were deemed to be retired from IAS. So I want to ask you, do you get two pensions? Because one from IAS and one from RBI?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't get two pensions.
Okay.
Because I was not a cadre employee of the Reserve Bank. I just went there as governor. So I get only one pension from the IAS. And even there, I don't get a full pension because I did not do 35 years of qualifying service. I went away to the World Bank for some time. Oh. So I get less than a full pension from the government.
So only RBI governors don't get pensions, is it? That's interesting.
No, unless they've been in
from the RBI.
But RBI governors don't get a pension just because they've been governors.
So you were finance secretary before you went to RBI. So what is the difference between work culture in IAS and in RBI? And I am asking not just from the IAS versus RBI perspective, but also your perspective, how it changes when you are a finance secretary, when you are the basically executing the government's will, and when you are trying to assert independence in RBI.
Yeah, on the first part of your question, which is that between the difference between the government and the RBI, the government's canvas is very wide. As finance secretary, my work canvas was indeed very wide. But as governor, the mandate is quite specific and the breadth of work is quite narrow.
Hmm.
So it was different in that sense. RBI is a more professional institution, staffed more largely by professionals, whereas government works in a secretarial style. So that's the difference. For me personally, it was that as finance secretary, I was an anonymous civil servant advising the government about what is to be done, helping the political executive take decisions and implement the decisions taken by them. So, but as RBI governor, I was the deciding authority. I was the head of the institution and the ultimate decision had to be taken by me.
Yeah, but in work culture, for example, there are a lot of IAS, for example, IAS officers are generalists.
Yeah.
Right? And in RBI, I think there are experts. In cadre, they have background, they have experience of working in one domain.
Right.
How that experience, what a government should learn from RBI and what RBI should learn from, say, IAS officers in that sense?
Well, I cannot give a very specific response to your question because there's lots of things one institution can learn from another. But from my own experience, let me tell you, if I was finance secretary and some query came, should we ask, for example, should we license private TV channels in Noida, for example? Then if I sent it down and say, write the pros and cons of this, a response would come back to me within 2 days, maybe 3 days. And give the subordinate secretariat, puts up something. Whereas if I asked a similar question in the RBI, the staff would do extensive research, in-depth research, because the governor asked for it and they'll come back maybe after a month when I moved on to other things. So that's the difference in the work culture of the government and the RBI.
So you say that in RBI it's more relaxed but more extensive?
I wouldn't say it's more relaxed.
Huh.
Certainly, that was not what I wanted to say.
Hmm.
But it is more intensive on research.
They will do PhD on that topic.
And on speed.
Okay.
Whereas in the government, it is more speed. I mean, so where do you find the balance between responding quickly and doing a thorough, not necessarily a thorough, but more intensive research?
So when you were finance secretary, there was a tussle between finance minister P. Chidambaram and the then governor of RBI, Y.V. Reddy. So the bone of contention was that the government wanted to use the forex reserves of RBI to fund infrastructure projects.
Right.
And you, as a finance secretary, was tasked to convince the governor, the RBI and the deputy governors for this. And then when you went to RBI, just before you went, 27th August, I think, 4 BRNs came in. And that was also, I think, people believe you know, that forbearance was as a response to the crisis of 2008, global financial crisis. But it was announced before, you know, these banks started collapsing in the United States. What was the intention behind forbearance?
I cannot recall the specific forbearance you're referring to or the exact date of that. I cannot recall that.
I think it was 27th August and you came on 7th September or something.
Yeah, it was before I went to the RBI. But I'm sure that the RBI must have had sufficient reason for that forbearance to encourage credit flow to certain sectors, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So it was, I'm sure, done with a specific public policy purpose.
And how do you see that Forex reserves, using Forex reserves for infrastructure funding?
As I write in the book myself, I had reservations about that because our Forex reserves are built out of our borrowing. They're not built out of our earnings, but out of our borrowings. And naturally, we have to be very careful about the perceptions that we send to the external world about our management of our balance of payments. If we start using our exchange reserves for whatever good purpose, financing infrastructure was a worthwhile purpose, but if we take them away, foreign confidence in India's balance of payments would have been shaken.
Yeah.
And even though we said with a reason that this is just a very small amount of a very large pool of reserves, this could actually end up being a thin end of the wedge, that more and more we get more relaxed about using foreign exchange reserves, actually deploying them.
Mm.
That would have, I think, compromised confidence in India's balance of payments.
So for youngsters who are watching this and who have no background in finance, can you explain what forbearance is before I ask a question on that?
Well, forbearance is that you give more relaxation to banks. Okay. Like, for example, if I take a loan from a bank and I default on payment, where within 90 days it's got to be, set, more provisioning has to be made. If it's defaulted for 180 days, more provisioning. They've got to set apart capital for it, depending on the risk weights. So if you relax these norms in order to comfort to the financial institutions and thereby to the borrowers because of some genuine problems, that is forbearance.
Recently, in 2020 and 2021 economic survey, one chapter was there, chapter number 7, and it had a lot of criticism. So if you allow me, I can quote from that.
Yes.
During the global financial crisis, forbearance helped borrowers tide over temporary hardship caused due to the crisis and helped prevent a large contagion. However, the forbearance continued for 7 years, from 2008 to 2015, though it should have been discontinued in 2011 when GDP, exports, IIP and credit growth had all recovered significantly. Yet, the forbearance continued long after the economic recovery, resulting in unintended and detrimental consequences for banks, firms and the economy. Given relaxed provisioning requirements, banks exploited the forbearance window for restructure loans, even for unviable entities, thereby window dressing their books. RBI initiated an asset quality review and then they found out that the NPAs, which were 2.2% in 2008, rose to 11%, more than 11% in 2015-16. So the prolonged forbearance policies following the GFC thus engendered the recent banking crisis that brought down investment rates and thereby economic growth in the country. Basically, the argument was that the forbearance...
The economic survey or the paper?
Yeah, I am quoting exactly from the economic survey.
Of which year?
2020-2021, chapter number 7. This was the argument that because of this forbearance that continued throughout your tenure in the RBI, which started before you came in, to be honest, that was the major reason why NPAs rose so sharply and banking crisis that took, I mean, we have recovered a couple of years back only, that NPAs have come down. So basically we wasted or we lost 15 years and economy had to suffer a lot.
Bear price.
Yes. So how do you see this criticism of yours?
That's a loaded question, but let me respond as best as I can. This criticism is done with the benefit of hindsight. What happened at that time? You're passing a judgment now. Whereas the Reserve Bank at that time, and I as the governor of that institution, we were acting in real time within the universe of knowledge available to us. So it is our judgment that we needed to continue out the forbearance. Let me give you, throw your mind back to that time when there were still concerns about financial stability. The global financial crisis actually lingered on for a couple of years, and then it mutated as segued into the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis. There was financial instability. There was not a credible signal that the crisis had ended. Okay, so we were informed by continued concerns about financial stability around the world, which might have a contagion effect on us. You might recall also that the ECB at that time had actually misread the situation, raised interest rates, in other words, reversed their easy policy, and then had to immediately backtrack when their financial stability was threatened. So we were also informed by that. So it is our judgment that given that situation, given that understanding in real time, it is necessary to continue this forbearance. It is with the benefit of hindsight, of course, there was a realization that it perhaps continued for too long, and then people passed judgments.
So one fundamental, for example, principle that your critics apply is that forbearance is for when there is a crisis in the economy, right? When there is no crisis, there is no need. For example, when COVID hit, forbearance came into the picture. But as they tried to remove it as soon as it was over, you write in your book that 2009, we had recovered. V-shaped recovery was visible. 2011, mein toh all the indicators were hinting at economic recovery, full economic recovery. I think we had 8 to 10% growth in 2009-10. So when that much recovery had happened in the economy, why not pull it back? Because they say that forbearance is like an emergency medicine. This is exactly what economic survey says, that this is an emergency medicine and you converted it into a staple diet.
Well, critics can say that. I acknowledge their prerogative to say that, but my explanation remains the same, which is that in real time, we were still concerned about financial instability. It's not just growth and inflation. There was the global financial crisis was a crisis of financial instability. It did not arise from a currency crisis or an inflation situation, right? So there was concerns about financial instability. Go back to 2012. The Eurozone sovereign debt crisis was still very much intense at that time. So we were acting in response to that.
But for example, I said that forbearance came before you came into the picture, and it was discussed for 1 year before that. So 2007, around 2007, when nobody knew that there will be global financial crisis. So in your assessment, why would RBI think of forbearance at a time when economy was doing good, when there was no sign of global financial crisis?
Perhaps because the financial sector was on a learning curve about investing in infrastructure. It was an uncharted territory, both for the corporates investing and for the banks which were lending to them. So perhaps RBI thought that we must give some time for them to make an adjustment to lending to infrastructure.
For 5 years, the main issue that you fought with was inflation. And government, actually, you can say in hindsight that was one of the biggest reasons why UPA lost so badly in 2014 elections. So when you look back, so much high inflation, and you write in your book, main reasons I think you have highlighted without, putting that much emphasis on it, that freebies, they were not called that, I think, at that time. Freebies like, farm loan waivers, MNREGA, all these policies were there. And if you look at the numbers, CAPEX from 2004 to 2009, that had declined severely. I think from 24% to 10%. So do you think
government CAPEX?
Yeah. So do you think that because of all these freebies and change in the economic behavior of people also, that inflation rose sharply and remained there for so long.
I wouldn't so much call them freebies. For example, Manrega, I wouldn't call that a freebie. That was, a safety net provided to people. And I said that to the Prime Minister. I say now that our inflation during 2010-11 was partly a problem of success. The affirmative action programs such as Manrega, etc., had put more money in the hands of poorer people, and they were spending that.
Hmm.
That caused inflation. Their food habits were improving. They were shifting from consuming cereal to consuming protein, which is a healthy thing to happen. But protein production did not catch up, so we had protein inflation. So as much as we had inflation, that had inflicted pain on the economy, inflicted pain on some people, some segments of the population. I also want to say that that inflation was a problem of success as much as it was a problem of some miscalculation.
So would you say that, for example, if a government doesn't want inflation to rise so sharply, so they should consider that they should not give so many, for example, let's say freebies, but this was not freebie, but too much money in the hands of people. Otherwise, there is a high risk of rising inflation.
No, too much money in the hands of people by itself is not a bad thing.
Hmm.
They must have enough spending power, but they must earn it.
Okay.
Rather than the government giving it.
But Manrega, they were earning, right?
They were earning. That's why I said I wouldn't call that a freebie.
Hmm.
Manrega, they were earning. So I would not call that a freebie.
And it was actually a very big amount. If you look at the percentage of GDP, I think 70,000 crores around that, or 40,000 crores. And then the farm loan waiver came, that was 70,000 crores. So these were around what, 4-5% of GDP, which will be around today's numbers, at least 5-6 lakh crores. So imagine someone, government giving 5-6 lakh crores scheme in one go. That would be a huge burden. And maybe that will rise. That will lead to rise in inflation.
But that's your own calculation. You know, I can't do all the calculation about how much it would have, to what extent that would have fueled inflation. But I do say that part of the inflation problem was because of the affirmative action programs. Okay, and production did not catch up. Therefore, we had an inflation problem.
So today also our spending, recently the news came out that our savings rate, that is a big concern, because if we compare it to China, that is around 40%, we are at 30%, it is declining. So how do you see that? Do you see that as a concern?
Well, yes, to the extent that savings translates into investment, I see that as a concern. But where are these savings coming from? If you want the bottom segments of the population to actually earn and spend, and you want the people who have surplus income in the upper segments of upper income segments of the population to save, right? So you want that to happen. You want savings rate to go up, but you also want consumption, especially of the poorer segments, to go up.
To go up?
Go up, yeah.
Okay.
Because if they consume, they spend. If they spur production, more production means more jobs. More jobs means more growth.
Hmm.
And we can get onto a virtuous cycle.
And what about middle class? For example, we are seeing a lot of criticism that, you know, there are young people in 20 to 30, they are partying too much and spending a lot of money. There is credit card culture, then UPI, because it is not visible that your money is going to for some payments. It is easier, you know, to spend. So how do you see that, you know, earlier middle class values were focused on saving. Now it seems that everybody wants to spend, you know, YOLO, you only live once, that culture is coming. So a lot of criticism on that. As an economist, how do you see that criticism? And
yeah, I don't want to pass a value judgment on how people are spending money or what youth is doing, whether they're frittering away money, etc. Those are different questions. But this view that youth are spending away too much money wastefully is shaped by an urban narrative. If you actually go into the hinterland of the country and see in the villages, your view will certainly change, because there are millions, in fact, hundreds of millions of households who struggle to make a daily living.
That's true. That's true.
So I don't want this narrative to shape our conversation now or shape economic policy. Certainly, if middle class values in the way you used it, which is something we stand by,
yeah,
those values, I think it's important to preserve them.
So when a person becomes RBI governor, even when they are in government, serving in government like you were as finance secretary, and when they move to RBI, there's a lot of talk about, we have to assert independence. But what is more important, for example, when, RBI's independence is more important or the national interest? So how do you balance that? For example, there is something that the government wants you to do as an RBI governor. So you think that it is good, but if you do it, you will be criticized for, taking the government line. So how do, as an RBI governor, how do you decide, like, I have to assert independence here and I have to go with the government here? What are the fundamental principles that you go by?
First of all, I think you said in your preface to this question that there is a tension between RBI autonomy and national interest.
Yeah,
I don't see any that sort of tension.
So we see a lot in the media that both are disagreeing.
I cannot debate against what the media is saying. I'm only giving you my own interpretation, which is that I don't see a conflict between RBI autonomy and national interest. In fact, I believe that RBI autonomy supports national interest. The second question is about how do you assert independence? I believe that it is important for the RBI to listen to stakeholders, as it actually does. Before every monetary policy review, RBI has a drill of consulting stakeholders such as banks, financial markets, non-banks, fintech companies, academics. And it also consults the government, because the government is one of the biggest stakeholders. It must listen to them with an open mind, take their inputs into view, but ultimately decide in what, as an institution, RBI believes is the larger public interest. Sometimes it might come into conflict with the government's objectives. Sometimes it might come into conflict with the government's political objectives. But that is par for the course.
So there is no conflict between, say, growth, inflation, what we have to prioritize more?
There is a conflict between growth and inflation. I can't deny that there is a conflict. But that conflict is only in the short term. In the long term, low and steady inflation actually supports growth. There is RBI research to show that if inflation is below 4%, it actually supports growth. Inflation above 4%, up to 6%, starts hurting growth. If inflation is above 6%, it actually is very bad, negative for growth. So there is, again, I'm stylizing a big picture,
Yes, yes.
Okay, it's you can nuance it further. It's not always that way. So there is a conflict occasionally in the short term between growth and inflation, and thereby there might be some tension between the central bank and the government.
So, for example, there is inflation is rising, for example, above 6%. So, as an RBI governor, how would you take decisions to bring it down? I'm just asking for people who don't have any background in this. And they read in the news that repo rate, RBI ne ghataya, badaya, and they don't understand how it impacts the common person. So, for youngsters, for people who with no financial or banking background, can you explain?
You're asking me to give a lesson.
Yes.
I'm not
You sure. are a teacher now.
I am a teacher, but I'm not sure that I'm a competent teacher. But let me try anyway, which is that inflation can come because of excess demand. That is, people are demanding more than the production capacity of the economy, or because there is a supply shock. For example, if oil price goes up, oil price has gone up, the supply is cut, India cannot afford to buy, therefore prices have to go up. Not because people want to consume more petrol and diesel, but because people are having to pay a higher price for the same amount of consumption. So inflation can come from a demand pressure or a supply shock. The instrument available to a central bank like the Reserve Bank of India for controlling inflation is the interest rate, like you mentioned. It is one single interest rate, which is the repo rate. The repo rate is the rate at which the RBI lends money overnight to commercial banks. Every day, banks have inflows and outflows of money. Sometimes they have excess surplus of cash. Sometimes they have shortage of cash. And a bank that has shortage has to borrow money because they've got to square their books. They borrow money in the market or in the interbank market. But when that borrowing is exhausted, if they still have a deficit, if, for example, a bank has more outflow than inflow on a particular day, it has to borrow overnight from the Reserve Bank of India at the repo rate of interest. So that repo rate of interest is the overnight borrowing rate for commercial banks from the Reserve Bank of India. The theory and practice is that that single interest rate influences the entire interest rate structure in the economy. For example, if you want to borrow money for your business, interest that the bank charges you for that business loan actually goes up if the repo rate goes up. Yeah. If you want to take an education loan for your son or your daughter, that education loan interest rate goes up. So if you want to deposit money in a bank, the deposit rate might go up. Okay, so that repo rate, which is the short-term overnight borrowing rate of commercial banks from the central bank, influences the interest rate structure of the economy.
And
now, when there is high inflation, RBI wants to control demand because in case one, inflation comes because of excess demand.
Yeah.
So what do? You increase the interest rate. You increase the repo rate, expecting that that interest rate will raise or influence the entire interest rate structure. For example, you want to take a business loan. Last month, your bank manager might have said, I will charge you 9.5%.
True.
But if in the intervening period of RBI has raised the interest rate, repo rate, your bank manager might today say that I've got to charge you 10.5%. Then what will you say? No, I can't afford it. So your demand for your loan has come down in the economy, right? So that's the demand that RBI wants to control. Typically not your business type of loan, that's production loan, but consumption loans, etc. So by raising the repo rate, RBI expects to influence the interest rate structure and thereby control demand, because demand has been the cause for inflation. Okay, that's case one. But you might ask, what if inflation comes from a supply shock? If inflation has gone up because international price of oil has gone up, our import price of oil has gone up, so what can repo rate do? Even if inflation comes from a supply shock, the theory is that if that inflation persists for long enough, inflation expectations get de-anchored and people expect inflation to be high. Mm-hmm. When people expect inflation to be high, inflation actually materializes to be high.
And
so even if monetary policy is not the most effective instrument for controlling inflation coming from a supply shock, it is still often one of the instruments used because of this inflation expectation problem.
You are a very good teacher.
Thank you for saying that. I have to improve.
So basically, when you are fighting inflation, as you said, that cost of doing business basically goes up because your borrowing rate also increases. So how this is basically have a direct impact on the growth.
Right.
So I have heard some politicians say that we should also protect 9%, 10% saving rates for the senior citizens, and we should also have easy money for the businesses also. So how these two are
it's a mathematical impossibility.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you can't, this is a math problem. You can't at the same time increase the deposit rate for depositors and savers and also reduce the borrowing rate. The only way you can do that is by banks becoming more efficient. The net interest rate margin, as they call it. But in the short run, that's not possible.
So how do we, this is the basically, you can say, trade-off, right? Inflation, growth, this will always be a struggle.
Yes, but as I said, it's only in the short term. In the medium to long term, if See, let's go back to that example. You want to take a loan at 9.5%. You've done your calculation. Borrowing at 9.5%, you're viable. But if interest rate goes up to 10.5%, you're not viable, right? So you drop that loan. That your economic activity that could have added to the economy has gone down. But then you improve yourself. Okay. So if prices are stable, and you think that 10.5%, this will remain as it is, I can take this for granted, then you're more confident about borrowing even at 10.5%. You will borrow and continue your business, thereby earn an income for yourself and add to economic activity. So in the medium to long term, price stability is important for households, businesses, and even government to take informed decisions about consumption and investment.
So it's a basically balancing act every institution has to do.
That is correct, including households.
So how do you, the recent, there is tussle, and you have written in your book also a lot of tussle between the government and RBI, and it's especially in the media, over RBI dividend. So some people say that dividend that the RBI gets is also people's money, and let government take it and invest in infrastructure and other things. The same argument with the forex reserves, right? So how do you see that, how much of dividend should be given to the government? What should be the terms and conditions? What is your opinion on that?
Well, the amount of dividend that the RBI gives to the government depends on the economic situation, how much of surplus the RBI has, because RBI calls it the surplus, not profit. RBI is not a commercial institution. Profit making is not one of its objectives. But because of the very nature of business that the RBI is in, it generates a surplus most of the time. That's not necessary that it always generates a surplus. When it generates a surplus, it provides money into reserves to provide for the stability of the markets and gives the balance to the government as dividend. The government, fiscally tight as it always is, wants RBI to give more, demands that the RBI give more, but RBI, in the interest of stability of the markets and stability of the economy, wants to hold sufficient reserves. So there is the tension again. But the tension on the dividend issue is not a policy issue. The tension on dividend issue is a more negotiable thing, right? And like you said, it's the same argument as the argument that we discussed for forex reserves. Because it is important for the economy that the RBI balance sheet be credible and strong. Typically, let's take a country, an economy whose government is weak, fiscally stretched, okay? And then it goes to the IMF, IMF assistance. The government is weak. So on whose strength should the IMF come to the rescue of the government? It is on the strength of the balance sheet of the central bank of that country. So for our own good, for our own stability, for our own economic credibility, it is important that the RBI balance sheet is strong. But of course, you cannot make it so strong that you buy too much insurance. So
only as much as you need it.
And that's a judgment call. Right? And that judgment call is negotiable.
Okay. But this is a good example of, national interest and RBI interests being the same.
I would think so.
Isn't it?
Most certainly.
Yeah. Because government would always want more. But you have to maintain RBI independence here.
Yeah.
So that you can, for the rainy day, you can have that as an insurance.
In theory and in practice, RBI interest is always consistent with the national interest.
Sir, as a banker, how do you see, you have written it, but I want you to explain it to the audience. The farm loan waiver was a big thing. And even now, politicians keep promising it. Your experience in 2008 when you were in the government and then you moved to RBI, how did you see that turning out, playing out in the open?
There was lots of discussion in the government. It wasn't done lightly. It was considered for a long time. several cabinet ministers were urging for farm loan waiver because of the distress in the agriculture sector. And the finance ministry was pushing back because of the fiscal problems, quite legitimate concerns on both sides of the debate. So the discussion went on for a long time. And finally, in 2008, the government decided that they would give a waiver. The expectation was that this will be a one-time waiver that would end all future waivers. In the event, it turned out to be the exact opposite, because it set off a huge number of waivers after that across states of the country, including states run by both the major political parties, both the BJP and the Congress. So to some extent, every major political party, including regional parties, have been guilty, if you want to call it that, of farm loan waivers. Farm loan waivers have a strong case because farmers are distressed. Market with the farm prices have not gone up as much as to make farming remunerative. So farmers are distressed. But is farm loan waiver the problem? They were the standard arguments, and appropriate arguments too, which is that there is a moral hazard. If you give a loan waiver, there's an expectation that in the future that there'll be more and more waivers and people would not repay. There is a question of people, you know, there was another equity issue also in the farm loan waiver that came up as well in that debate. Which farmer gets a loan? It is the relatively better off farmer who gets a loan.
Who have some collateral to,
give. The marginal small farmers and agriculture labor don't get a loan at all.
Yeah.
So if you're waiving loans, you're actually, within the farming community, you're actually giving support or safety net to the better off segment. Is that equitable? Should the government not be going to the protection of people who are even more deprived? So these are all questions. These are all not just value judgments. These are like economic questions, right? So the government decided that we'll give this one-time waiver and hopefully farm sector will take off and become remunerative. That did not prove to be the case. So we've had farm loan waivers, a series of them since then.
Actually, if you look at it, DBT, for example, input for their input cost to buy seeds, fertilizers, etc., you can give some token money every farming season. That would be much better help than, say, farm loan waivers without all these consequences, negative side effects.
Yeah, but that's what they're doing now, right?
Yeah, that's what they
Pradhan Mantri, right?
Raitu Bandhu is in Andhra.
Yeah, Raitu Bandhu in Andhra, but it's across the country and Government of India is giving it?
Yeah, that is different. I mean, they're giving 2,000 rupees per quarter.
Yeah.
So 6,000 rupees a year.
8,000 or 6,000?
I think 6,000.
6,000, yes.
Yeah.
So they're giving support to farmers by way of DBT. Hopefully that is appropriately timed.
You mentioned one negative thing about the current tax regime, that the GST regime that is there presently. And you mentioned it as a cess culture. So I want you to explain it to the people. I don't think you call it cess culture. I am saying it.
Right.
But how do you see that? Because when the government, central government puts cess, all of it goes to the central government. When there is GST rate changes, that is divided between states. And so that's why more and more cesses are coming from the central government, because they get to keep it.
Yeah. Under the arrangement of tax sharing and taxation purpose, and it is constitutionally ordained, it's not just one political party or one government, the part of the tax collected by the center is to be distributed among states. That is part of the fiscal federal arrangement we have. So how that tax should be distributed among states is a horizontal distribution issue, and we appoint a finance commission every 5 years to determine that. According to the award of the last finance commission, 41% of the central tax pool is to be given to the states and distributed. That means if the government of India collects 1 rupee as tax, 41 rupees is given away to states and the government of India gets to keep only 59 paise. And how that 49 paise is divided across states is a horizontal distribution formula.
Yeah.
Government of India is itself constrained. The center is constrained fiscally. So they also have problems in giving more and more to the states, whereas states are demanding that that share of 41 must actually go up to 50, 60, whatever. Whereas center wants 41 to remain as it is. In fact, they want it to be reduced, but they say that they plead their inability to raise that because both sides, there are fiscal compulsions. So one workaround that the central government has discovered and used sparingly at the beginning and more extensively now is to levy surcharges and cesses. Because under the constitutional arrangement, only taxes collected by the center are shareable. But if the government collects 1 rupee as tax, said they have to give away 41 paise to the states. But if the government, central government, imposes a surcharge of 10% on income tax, that surcharge is not part of the tax pool and therefore need not be shared. So if they collect 1 rupee as surcharge, that entire 1 rupee goes to the center. So they have some interest in that.
And
the intention of surcharges and cesses was that they'll be for a specific purpose for a short term and will not be resorted to extensively. It'll be very sparing.
Can't we outlaw it somewhat?
Outlawing it is impractical. For example, let me give you an example. COVID, right? Health expenditure had to go up and suddenly you have to spend more. So you impose a surcharge for a short period and that is levied by the center and spent by the center. Okay. But as soon as COVID has abated, it is incumbent on the government to withdraw that. But that doesn't happen. As Milton Friedman said, there's no such thing as
a temporary government program.
Nothing more permanent than a temporary government program.
Yeah, and that is the problem. They never, withdraw all these cesses, taxes that they impose. So you have worked with so many politicians in Andhra Pradesh, starting with the NTR and prime ministers. So who is your most, favorite politicians as a professional?
Well, I can't really answer that question. It'll be impolitic on my part. Okay. But I had the privilege of working with very experienced political leaders. Of course, they had their political compulsions. On the whole, I would say that it's been a varied but rich experience for me. A
lot of people who don't interact with politicians, who only watch them on TV and, they have a different opinion versus the people who, work with them. So did your perception change after you started interacting, working with them?
Politicians are not a homogeneous group. They cover the entire spectrum in terms of commitment, knowledge levels, experience, expertise, as indeed is true of the civil services. So I cannot give a ballpark response to politicians. But one thing I would say that some of the misgivings that I had, actually, they became misgivings because I realized that I was wrong. I had my respect and appreciation for politicians had gone up. For example, there was that microfinance crisis in 2010 when I was governor. And I was called before the Parliament Standing Committee to explain if the Reserve Bank was actually sleeping at the wheel and did not see the microfinance crisis brewing. Par for the course, I have no complaint about that. But during that interaction, I realized that politicians, MPs who were coming from different parts of the country, had inputs to give into that debate that the RBI as a professional institution did not see.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I believe that political input can add value even to strictly political, strictly professional policy issues.
For example, what's your most memorable compliment that you received from a politician?
I can't recall many compliments that I received.
Come on, sir.
I've not received many compliments.
Let's say, let's start with NTR.
No, NTR, for example, I was officer on special duty for Eric Bottling. I write about that in the book. Mr. N.T. Rama Rao, he was anxious, worried, aghast that thousands and tens of thousands of people die every year because they drink adulterated liquor. And he was pained by that because that was causing loss of life and livelihoods.
Mm.
So the solution was to bottle liquor and sell it. And they decided that they would set up government bottling plants to bottle liquor so that people know when they're buying liquor that this is non-adulterated. And I was appointed as officer on special duty for implementing that program. And there were lots, so I write about that adventure in my book.
Hmm.
But when the project was done, Mr. Ramarao complimented me for doing it.
Hmm.
So that was a happy memory.
And any prime minister who complimented you well?
Well, in private, yes, perhaps, but, you know.
But not in public. Why do they don't compliment
you? They do, in fact. Dr. Manmohan Singh, when he came for the Platinum Jubilee of the Reserve Bank of India in 2010, he complimented an entire line of governors, including me.
Huh.
And Prime Minister Modi complimented Governor Das more recently. So they do compliment.
Okay. One very, beautiful insight that your book has, it's on when you went outside of the country and you saw that the scarcity mindset that we usually grow up with.
Yeah.
And the plentiful mindset that the people in, in developed countries have. That was a very important insight that I really want you to share with the people who are watching this.
Well, thank you. All my life until I joined IAS, indeed, even after I joined the IAS, I experienced life in India. And as a student, and even after joining the IAS, I traveled by a bus several times on private trips. And, on trains, on buses, and we have more demand than supply. So there's lots of overcrowding in buses sometimes you cannot get. So when a bus comes and stops, you're worried that the bus might go away before you got in. So you push people away and try to get into the bus because a seat in the bus or indeed even standing space in a bus is a scarce commodity.
Exactly.
So you attach a lot of value to it, even if you have to push away people, older people, infirm people, you put yourself first and push and get into the bus. Because you're struggling for that scarce commodity. And our mindset is shaped by that scarcity value. Indeed, the scarcier a commodity is, the more we value it.
Mm-hmm.
It's written in economics textbooks. So when I went to the U.S. for study, I went there when I was about 27, 3 or 4 years after I joined the IAS, I was on a university campus and the university bus had come. And there were about 25 of us waiting to get into the bus. My instinct was to push people away. I pushed people away trying to get into the bus. And around me, other students were looking like I was, how barbaric is this guy?
Mm.
And trying to push us away. What's the need? Everybody's going to get in. The bus is stopping. We'll stop until it takes everybody in.
Yeah, you're not even sure in India that the bus will stop.
Yeah. So, but my behavior was shaped by the scarcity in India. But gradually, I absorbed that culture of adequacy or plentiful.
Hmm.
Plenty.
Actually, this dehumanizes us in a way, if you look at it, that we don't see that who needs it. No, this is our tunnel vision is that I should go there and I should get a seat.
And it's partly a I would think there's partly an offshoot or a consequence of poverty, but even rich people do that.
Because the mindset is shaped by that. Because the commodity is very limited, and you should be able to get it.
Right.
Otherwise, you will get left behind. Yeah, you will be left behind. So this is basically we are better human if we don't have that scarcity mindset. Actually.
Among other things, it takes a lot of things to make a better human.
Yeah, but this is one of the, you mentioned that you went to university and there was this student who was, your fees was something really, So that also shows, that
the immediate culture.
Yeah, the culture is itself makes you slightly a better human being than.
I think so, yeah.
Sir, lastly, you have been in academia ever since you quit RBI and the government job. So how do you feel there is a difference between, say, academia in India versus what is there in the West or even Singapore?
Well, I had the privilege of going to quality institutions. In India, higher education spans the entire spectrum. We have institutions like the IITs, IIMs, AIMS, NITs, and some other good universities. But at the other end, we have low levels, low quality higher education. And the student quality also varies. That's the same, I think, around the world, although the average levels might be higher in richer countries. But I had the privilege of going to some better, good universities, premier universities in the world, like Yale, for example, or University of Pennsylvania, National University of Singapore. So students are more motivated. Of course, they're getting, you know, the cream of students, but they're highly motivated.
And in approach of teachers also, is there a difference? For example, people say that we don't have a research culture here, whereas in the West, in, you know, developed countries.
Yeah, I believe I'm not a higher education specialist, but people say that quality of teaching also goes up when teachers in higher educational institutions such as universities, IITs and IIMs do research.
Okay.
They not only have to teach, but their teaching goes up as a consequence of research. They must do research and also teach.
Okay. Sir, it's been 11 years since you quit RBI and you're out of the decision making in financial matters, economic matters. Is there anything that you saw in these 10 years, more than 10 years, that you thought, ki, if I was there, I would have done this differently? Or maybe I didn't like this. Maybe they should do that. Do you feel that in some policy, or do you feel generally that, okay, this should change? This is not going right.
Why generally? Every day I feel that this should change. Every day.
But what is most closest to your, you know, heart? That, okay, I want to work on that. I wish I would get the opportunity.
Since you ask, I want to work on the quality of service delivery in our country. Because, you know, when I was in the government, the orthodox CEO used to be that things are bad because everything is being done by the government. If we privatize, things will be better.
Yeah, that is there.
But my experience over the last, not just over the 11 years since I've left the government, but even when I was in the government, that India's private sector is also not much better than the government. There is callousness, there is inefficiency, even within the private sector. We think there's been competition. Competition has helped to some extent, but there is still a lot of inefficiency, poor quality in the private sector. So that has caused me concern and also sadness.
But look at Singapore. They are also able to do it. The government does a lot of things.
Government does a lot of things, but even the private sector does very well. There is much greater accountability. There's much greater credibility to the government. I'll give you an example. Suppose you're to get a salary and they've deducted something from your salary and they've made a wrong deduction. And you say, look, you cut more than you should have. Then they say, oh, did we? We'll get back to you by the 10th of June. Here, if they don't, first of all, they don't respond. Even if they respond, they don't say 10th of June.
For months.
If they say 10th of June, they will not respond even for in the 10th of June next year. But in Singapore, what I noticed was that if they say, we'll get back to you on this on the 10th of June, latest by the 10th of June, the government gets back to you. For example, I had to get an income tax refund in Singapore. I claimed a refund. Immediately, I got a response from them that's, we received your case. We're going to get back to you by the 10th of June. And sure enough, I got a response, including refund, by the 10th of June.
So how can we do that in India, sir?
Well, lots of things have to change. We can't discuss this in a short interview like that. But we have to work on a lot of things.
But do you think there is a scarcity of people? You know, we don't hire enough people.
No, I don't think that's a problem, but that's not necessarily the biggest problem.
But just one problem you can cite and we will close it.
No, I think it's a question within the government, it's a question of accountability.
Okay.
And even within the private sector, it is a question of accountability. If I go to one insurance company and that gives me poor service, I will go to another company if I know that that company is going to be any better. But if I know that that company is equally bad, how is competition serving me?
So it's also a cultural thing it has become, because we don't hold people to account for their inactions or, you know.
Yeah, it is the Chaltaya attitude.
Yeah.
Now, I'm giving you examples and examples. If I'm in a traffic situation and there's an ambulance blaring, hooting behind me, people don't give way.
Yeah.
No, that is just not the right thing to do.
Or you may have noticed that somebody will, you know, tag behind that ambulance out of, you know, easily.
Yeah, get out of a jam.
Yeah.
Rather than giving way to the ambulance.
Yeah.
And I think that is way to change our culture.
We actually don't punish people, for example, for breaking rules. That is the biggest problem.
Absolutely.
That is also part of accountability. So thank you so much. You gave so much time, and I'll just show your book. Just a Mercenary?
Thank you, Hasan. Yeah,
thank you so much, sir.
You are, and I'm impressed by your diligence.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.